I want to start us off with just a few questions to prime our minds about what we're doing. Who were they? That's what we're after finding out. How many of them were there? Were there really three? Someone told me this morning there was an article in a paper saying another tradition says there were 12. I mean, do we know? Did they really ride camels? This is a vexed question. And if so, how did three guys on camels become so important? So let's just consider where the majority of people get their ideas from. I'm not talking about you good folks here, but just generally the majority of people. Where do they get their ideas from? Well, nativity plays, I think, is a good source of information for some, particularly the innkeeper. Christmas cards, that's another source of information that people will use. And, of course, that marvellous carol we've sung earlier today, "We Three Kings of Orient Are." So that's perhaps all the information many people feel they need. Let's consider where that set of information was informed from. The Historia Triarum Regum, my Latin's not very good, I apologise. The History of the Three Kings by John of Hildesheim. Perhaps you have a copy on your shelves. But just in case you haven't referenced it lately, he tells us they were kings from the eastern lands of Ind, Chaldea and Persia. And that they met en route, not knowing each other beforehand, three kings, three totally different countries, met on the way and agreed to travel together. He names them Melchior, Balthasar, and Jasper or Casper, depending on the translation you get there. And after their encounter with the Christ, they agreed to meet every year and even to be buried together. So impactful did they feel their visit was. Buried in the same tomb. No regard to whatever their families were buried, anything like that. They were going to just the three of them in this tomb. That tomb was later discovered by St. Helena, who was mother of Constantine. And she saw this grave with three skeletons, and she just knew they were the wise men. So she recovered their skeletons, and she took them to Constantinople as holy relics. And should you so wish, you can go and visit these same bones in Cologne Cathedral, and they're beautifully displayed, or hidden, I suppose, in this gorgeous box, gilded box. So if you want to go there, enjoy. My question today is, what should we believe? First of all, do we believe all this I've told you so far? So let's start again. What do we know? Well, we had our start of our reading there that told us, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." That's kind of the full set of information, really. But we can gather a lot more information if we start taking in historical sources, some Old Testament references, other New Testament things, and we can fill out this picture somewhat. First of all, some history. Magi is from the Greek word magoi, magos. It basically means it's the name of a people. It's not a translatable word, it's just the name of a people, the Magi. They were a tribe within the larger group, the Medes. They had interests in astronomy and astrology. Oh, and they were a hereditary priesthood tribe, like the Levites. In Israel, they were a priesthood tribe. They had some involvement in activities that today we would reference as sorcery, though, given I don't believe much in sorcery, I'm not entirely sure what that means. I've got to be honest with you, I'm not into the Harry Potter magic. I enjoy the shows, but the books, but does it really work? I don't think so. But because of this, Magi has become corrupted into the word we use today, magic. So that's where we get magic from. In terms of empires, the Magi are a very, very ancient people. Some will trace the origin of the Medes to the time when Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldeans. The majority of historians see them as a Semitic people, which takes them all the way back to Noah's son Shem, the same root as the Jews and Arabs of today. Very, very ancient people. They held a significant place in the empires of the Orient, and here's some listed here for you, I won't read them out, but where they had prominence and a place. The Magi were key people in the governments of the East, or at least the senior magi, I suppose I should say, were key people in the governments of the East. Political. They always appear with tremendous political power when they occur in the writings. And this is important to the story and the picture we're building together. An individual magus would rise by virtue, not just because they're the son of somebody or so on. If you're in the tribe, you had a chance, but then you rose by virtue. In the same way that you just can't go around and call yourself a doctor and practice medicine, you actually have to go to school, learn, be examined, and prove your skills and aptitudes to this thing. So too were the magus rising up through the ranks of the magi. They had a unique priestly position within society. They're regarded as having occultic powers of divination. They had the astronomical knowledge going for them, and they were advisors to the royal court of the East. Hence, we call them wise men. They were the wise men who would be consulted about various matters. In terms of their religion, their worship, they were monotheistic. The principal element of their worship was fire, and they had a primary altar which burned with a perpetual flame believed to have been kindled by God. And then they had a second altar which they used for blood sacrifices, and that altar was lit with a flame from the primary altar, and the sacrifice was then eaten by the priests and the worshippers together. In fact, it's almost a direct parallel to the true worship within Judaism. And these priests carried small bundles of divining rods with them to divine God's will or to divine the truth in much the same way as the Urim and the Thummim and the priests of Israel. They believed in clean and unclean animals, and they had a ritualistic treatment of dead bodies. So the parallels with Judaism are significant in that religious background. They became advisors to the reigning king. So whoever was in charge, these people were there to advise. And to give you a specific example, Jeremiah 39:3 and verse 13, amongst the two or three princes of Babylon who were listed and there at the sacking of Jerusalem with Nebuchadnezzar, there's a wonderful name, Nergal-Sharezer, the Rabmag. Great title. He was listed among the princes. If we translate that more fully, we see he was Nergal-Sharezer, the chief magician, the chief magi. The magi were up there in the government. In fact, Cyrus and Darius are known to have royal court officials drawn from the magi. Okay, so these guys are important. If we think specifically in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, of course, we always automatically think of Daniel. And Daniel, you remember the challenge that Nebuchadnezzar gave to his wise people. I've had a dream. Please tell me what it means. And they said, tell us the dream and we'll tell you what it means. He said, no, I'm not going to tell you. Otherwise, you could be pretending. I want you to tell me without me telling you the dream. And when they couldn't, he said, well, let's kill them all. He would just kill them all. He had enough. They answered him back, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. And just as a side note, I'll point out that Chaldean, it's quite likely to have been an equal name for the Magi. I think those three words we saw, we can see, are referring just to that one group of people. Well, a special skill of the Magi was meant to be interpreting dreams. He wasn't so unreasonable in asking them to interpret a dream. But they failed, of course, for Nebuchadnezzar, because he wouldn't tell them what the dream was. But Daniel succeeded. With the help of God, Daniel succeeded. The king was planning to kill all the Magi. He was in a fit of some sort. Daniel had just saved their lives. He just saves their lives. I imagine they were grateful. And Daniel was appointed chief of the Magi, chief of all the wise men of Babylon, within that wonderfully named group we saw. And now he's in a position to dispense knowledge of God's plans, God's history in dealing with the people of Israel, and God's future kingdoms that, of course, he had the visions about, to the wise men. Now, I think this is God's planning, and I put this in italics because this is a little bit of speculation on my part, but I think God's setup was now done, or at least in large part. The Magi could now show up to worship the baby Jesus hundreds of years later because they now had the information and they now had the respect for this man Daniel and for all he taught and therefore his people and everything that came from that. I think that's God controlling history, people. I think that's God controlling history. Excuse me. Magian power, not the magic kind, the political kind. They were powerful. They were influential. In Babylonian and Medo-Persian times, all nobility was schooled by them. No Persian could become king unless two criteria were met. He had mastered the scientific and religious teaching of the Magi. And he was approved and crowned by the Magi. That's power. That really is power. A quick dip into Zoroastrianism. I knew you were waiting for that this morning. The religion of Zoroastrianism is named after its founder, Zoroaster. The Magi adopted this, became their national religion and adapted it as they needed. And so in later Greek writings you find the Magi referred to as Zoroaster's disciples, Zoroaster's pupils. So by the time you get to the New Testament times, there's a mix of views going on. You've got the original Magian views, of course, you've got Zoroastrianism, and you have those true seekers after God, who have been preserved there by God, waiting for the coming of the true Messiah. There are two other Magian encounters in the New Testament. You can perhaps think of them, but I'll remind you anyway. In Acts 8:9, now for some time a man named Simon had practiced sorcery in the city and amazed all the people of Samaria. And in 13:8, but Elymas the sorcerer, for that is what his name means, opposed them and tried to turn the proconsul from their faith. Sorcery and sorcerer, those words as they appear in the NIV, literally in the Greek is magos, which is the practice of being a magi. It's just another word for the magi. These were magi. So we can see that some magi were honest and exalted the craft of wisdom and political advice, and some were corrupt, using their knowledge to promote selfish ends. For their own selfish gains. Both these men would have been Jews who had obtained Magian knowledge and when they were using it for their own purposes. Philo, so kind in his writing, writes about the Magi. They are vipers, they are scorpions, and they are other venomous creatures that presumably I can't be bothered to name at the moment. Simon and Elymas were the type of people who made the Romans despise the Magi. Think about the political situation in the New Testament times. Rome was nervous of the Eastern Empire. You see, technically, Rome ruled, but it was a long way to the east, and so there was a separateness to the east. And the Roman and Parthian empires had fought on a number of occasions in the past. The Parthian Empire was feared. They were nervous about it in Rome. On the other end of that, in the Parthian Empire, the ruling house were called the Megasthenes. Any of you thinking of naming children? I think it's a great name. The Megasthenes. They were totally composed of magi. And it was their duty to have absolute choice for the selection of a king. That was their job. They got a problem with their previous king, Phraates IV, and they were now looking for a new king of the East who could come against Rome, who could lead them. A great king. See, Herod was old. Augustus was old. Caesar Augustus was hanging on to life by a thread. And the Roman army no longer had a strong ruler in charge of it. And during that time, there was a widespread expectation of a coming great king. Roman historian Suetonius, speaking at that time, said, "There had spread over all the Orient an old and established belief that it was fated at that time for men coming from Judea to rule the world." Magi knew this was time to bring about an Eastern revolt against the West. The time was right. Well, the Magi arrive in Jerusalem. How did they arrive? They would have arrived, ridden, with appropriate pomp and entourage. It wouldn't have been three guys staggering through the desert, honestly, folks. They'd have been wearing Persian finery. I found this extract from a tapestry I thought you might enjoy. And they used to wear conical hats, the Persians did, by the way, rather than any other sort of hat. Conical hats were in vogue. And they rode Persian steeds. I'm sorry if you love the camel idea. They were riding horses. The Persians were famed for their horses and their horsemanship and being able to fire arrows backwards while riding and so on. They were a feared and fearsome army. So these Magi arrive in Jerusalem. And there are some estimates in history that we don't know the actual number, but it may have been up to 1,000 mounted cavalry came with them. No danger of these folks being ambushed on the way across from the east to the slightly less east, that is the Middle East. 1,000 mounted cavalry. Imagine that lot arriving in town. Especially if you know that Herod's army were out of town on a mission. They were out of the country on a mission. Which leads us to dear Herod, such a kind man. He had a title, King of the Jews. He'd gained that title from Caesar Augustus. He'd worked really hard to get that title. And he fought to keep the state under his control. He would have anybody murdered who he thought posed a threat. It wasn't a good thing to be a brother to Herod. It's a very short life expectancy. And then what happens? This coterie of Persian kingmakers arrive in town. And what's worse, they start asking around about the new king of the Jews. How would you react if you were him? Matthew 2:3. When Herod the king heard of this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. You bet he was. I found this rather interesting painting someone had done of what they thought Herod looked like. He looks a bit troubled to me. Herod was troubled. The word in Greek that's translated troubled there is literally agitated. He was kind of shaking like a washing machine shakes on spin cycle. He'd heard these Oriental kingmakers arrived and he was rattled. I have no doubt about that. So, the Magi, what do? They began asking around, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? The Greek construction tells us they went around the city questioning whomever they met. They kept asking. It was a continual asking. You know, the Magi as foreigners knew of this monumental birth, and they probably expected that the children of Israel, of course, would know about it. And maybe, if not in the countryside, then certainly in the city, in Jerusalem, that somebody there would know where to find this special baby. Must have been a little shocked to find out that nobody seemed to know what they were talking about. And in fact, Herod had to gather the chief priests and teachers of the law in order to get them an answer, at least of the town, rather than the actual child. No one just seemed to know what these guys were talking about. Well, whatever the Magi thought about that, when they found Jesus, they worshipped him. They were not put off. They were not discouraged. They knew who they were looking for. And when they found him, they worshipped him. And I would encourage anybody else to do the same. And just a side note, that in Matthew's Gospel, the first people to recognize the true king were Gentiles. They were not Jews. They were Gentiles. So let's draw a few thoughts together. You just listened to a lot of history, basically. It's kind of pulling bits and pieces together to create a picture for you. I wonder if you thought it was interesting. If you did, I think it's because you're seeing God in action. You're seeing God directing history to his story, as we say. It was and is a sad fact that the people who should have known about the birth of the king missed it, and those who really shouldn't have known showed up and worshipped the true king. It reminds us that if his own people were not going to praise him, God was going to arrange history to make sure that someone was there to praise him, to praise his son, to give him the honour and glory that was rightfully his. At this time of year, many people celebrate Christmas, but I think few people celebrate and worship the coming of the true king. Let's make sure we're among those who do worship the true king this Christmas. Thank you.